everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. It turns out that 50 million adults in the United States are checked out and have no disease, or they aren't responding to medical treatment, despite the fact that they feel sick. They're experiencing pain or illness that is not caused by either injury or disease. This is very frustrating for both their medical providers and for the patient, and for the provider who has no training in what to do next to evaluate them for their stress or their trauma. So joining me today is my very special guest, Dr. David Clark. How are you doing?
Just great, apart from the fact that it's 100 degrees in Portland, Oregon, which we're not used to here. But other than that, it's a beautiful day.
All I can say is, wow. And I am glad that is not the case here in the Chicago area. So, you know, I hope you have, you know, adequate air conditioning, ventilation, some fans, some pools nearby, something to help keep you cooled off.
Well, plus I'm a stress expert, so that helps.
Absolutely, that helps. I'm sure there's a lot of folks that could use your expertise right now.
Yeah, I'm thinking, especially as we record this in South Texas, where there's a hurricane coming ashore. But there's stress all over the world that needs attention, and gonna enjoy talking to you about that.
Yes, well, you know what? I'm especially excited to talk with you today. To be honest with you, I mean, this is almost like Christmas for me, frankly. It's just, you know, I think that your understanding and work and the insight that you bring to this topic is just so needed by both, you know, medical providers, me as a physician, you know, the nurse practitioners and the PAs, and but also by patients. So I think this is, you know, this fantastic we're having this conversation today.
Thank you. Yeah, it's hard to believe just how ill you can get from stress, which then causes changes in the physical structure of the brain, which then causes pain or illness in the body that for all the world feels like it's being generated by an organ or a structure. I mean, you could swear on a stack of Bibles that your pain is coming from, let's say, your low back. But it's not. It's being generated by the brain in the majority of cases. The good news is that by identifying the stress that's responsible for this, we can treat that. And when we do, people get better, sometimes very quickly. Sometimes they need, you know, several years of psychotherapy. But either way, people know that they're on a pathway toward healing, and symptoms that they might have had for years or even decades in some cases can be successfully treated.
Well, that is wonderful news to hear for those who are struggling and suffering. And again, even for myself, who, you know, takes care of, you know, patients with mental health issues and can't find relief. And as you well know, obviously, when you have, you know, mental illness, that's, you know, because of the overlying pathways, and some of those things are similar. Some of them is, again, because you talked about the stress and the lack of self-care, then it just magnifies
that and makes it worse. So again, I think, you know, it's beneficial to both, you know, me as a doctor, but also the patients. So, you know, I want to get into it and share with folks, you know, exactly who Dr. David Clark is, at least a little snippet, right? So Dr. David Clark is the president of the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, which is a not-for-profit dedicated to ending the chronic pain epidemic. Dr. Clark holds a medical degree from the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and is board certified in internal medicine and gastroenterology. His organization's mission is to advance the awareness, diagnosis, and treatment of stress-related and brain-generated medical conditions. And so, of course, you can learn more at his organization, endchronicpain.org. So welcome again.
Thank you very much. Yeah, endchronicpain.org has been around now for since 2011, and we are always putting more information on there that is deliberately written jargon-free so everybody can understand it. And we're having a live conference September 26th to 28th in 2024 in Boulder, Colorado, which is open to the public. It's going to be mostly healthcare professionals. We've got over 24 international speakers, but it's open to everybody.
Okay. That sounds good. So will both, you know, the public and medical providers be attending?
Yeah, because we ask everybody to speak in that in a way that's jargon free, because we want the medical clinicians to be able to understand the psychological material, and we want the mental health professionals to be able to understand the organ and structure material. And what that does is it opens it up for everybody, even people who are not healthcare professionals, to learn about this.
Yeah, and I think that that's really wonderful that you're doing it that way. In my own, you know, work, but also in terms of my own learning and education, I found that if I keep it simple, then it's easy for anyone that I'm talking with or working with to then not only understand what I'm saying, but to actually make use of it, because they're not going, huh?
Yeah, it's hard for us who've been through medical school. I mean, we learn this jargon and it becomes second nature to us. And it's so much easier and quicker to communicate with our fellow professionals using these technical terms that we get used to it. And we forget when we're talking to somebody who's not a healthcare professional that they need to be addressed in plain English. And it's like speaking a foreign language to go back to that. But it's something I've always taken pride in. I've taught a lot of medical students how to do that and made them aware of the importance of doing that. And it makes such a big difference in the outcomes for the patients and in their understanding of what is happening to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that is definitely a great thing. So you know what? Why don't you share with us how you got into this, to this work? Because I think it's kind of a fascinating story.
Yeah, it was never supposed to happen. I was supposed to be a perfectly normal gastroenterologist. I mean, I went through the first 7 years of my formal training, 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency, not knowing a thing about this. Uh-huh. And in spite of I didn't know a thing, I was still successful in my training. I mean, I got an award for excellence in medical school. I got into my dream residency program. I was getting high scores on the board exams. Everything seemed to be going great. So the last thing I expected was to run into a patient that I didn't know the first thing about diagnosing or treating. And this patient had been sent to us from another university because they couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. She was averaging, if you're squeamish, you might turn the sound down right now, but she was averaging one bowel movement per month for the previous 2 years, in spite of taking 4 different laxatives at double the usual doses, and it wasn't working.
Wow.
So we're what we did at UCLA, where I was in training, was some specialized testing of the electromechanical properties of the large intestine. And my department chair and I, we knew that that test was going to show what the problem was, because, you know, as far as we were concerned, there was no other possible explanation. Well, no, that test was normal too. So, you know, we were baffled, and it was left to me to essentially do her exit interview and tell her, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to live with this. Many of my patients over the years have heard that, and it's not true. So I was telling the patient this, and just, you know, so that it wouldn't be a 60-second conversation, asked her about stress. And, you know, she didn't have any. She was happily married. She had two kids. She worked half-time in a bank. Everything seemed to be fine. So I asked her about stress earlier, meaning, you know, 2 years before when her illness had first started. That turns out to be an important question for people with these unexplained symptoms. And that was when she started telling me not about 2 years before, but about when she was a girl, when she had suffered hundreds of sexual assaults by her own father. And I had never heard a story like that from a patient. I had never heard about any kind of child abuse from a patient before, because I hadn't ever been taught to ask about that. So here was this patient with this completely unexplained severe illness and this horrible childhood experience, but they were 25 years apart from each other. Nobody had touched her against her will for 25 years. So could it possibly be connected to her illness? Once again, I had no idea. I had no training. I had no background in how to diagnose or even suspect that there might be a connection. Fortunately, there was a psychiatrist, a member of your profession, Dr. Durr, named Harriet Kaplan, who I knew was interested in these mind-to-body connections. And I thought, you know, at least I've got something I can do for this patient besides telling her she's going to have to live with it. But I never thought anything would come of it. I sent her off to Harriet and moved on with my my career and my training. But 3 months later, I ran into Harriet in an elevator. And this was the elevator ride that changed my career, because I asked Harriet, just to make conversation, what happened with that patient? And Harriet had cured the patient. You know, in less than 3 months of weekly counseling sessions, the idea that such a thing was possible, that you could cure somebody's serious physical illness just by talking to them, nobody ever taught me that either. So, you know, I've had massive respect for the psychiatric profession ever since. And Harriet gave me a basic framework for how to think about patients with these problems, how to talk to them, how to assess them, the very beginnings of how to treat them. But I never thought I was going to do any of that myself. I thought, you know, maybe two or three patients a year I might run into that had this kind of issue. I was wrong in so many different ways. I mean, just so many different ways. I got into private practice and I was seeing five or six patients like this a week. Every time my diagnostic tests were normal, I would ask the questions that Dr. Kaplan had taught me to ask. And over and over and over again, I'm finding these massive stresses in people's lives that often they were not fully recognizing the severity of those things themselves. And I would send them off to the mental health department, fully expecting that they would get appropriate diagnosis and treatment there. They did not. They got cognitive behavioral therapy, which turns out not to be sufficient for most of these patients. And so they would come back and they would say, I went to mental health. I did not get any better. Now what do we do? And so I said,
So because you know what, there's a number of things that you said that, that to me raises questions. Okay. So one, I say to folks, you know, your brain is not in a separate container from the rest of your body.
Not if you have a neck. If you've got a neck, they're connected.
You know, and on top of the thing, like literally the brain is running everything except for a few simple reflexes. So to me, it's interesting that in Western medicine, that we're just starting to evolve into this, you know, this mind body medicine thing. And I'm just kind of going, bruh, it's just like the kind of obvious, you know, they're connected, right? It's running, everything is connected.
It's incredible what the brain can do to your body.
As I like to say, you know, over time, because everything we think and feel is connected to a chemical, right? Over time, emotional dis-ease becomes physical disease. So if we have that understanding, then, you know, the stuff again that we call in holistic medicine or holistic approaches or, you know, all of that, it should just make sense. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you though is what were those five questions that she taught you to ask?
Okay. It's what I call a stress evaluation, and okay, it's important to be open to doing this, with people who don't look the least bit stressed out. I mean, most of my patients, they don't have any kind of mental health condition. They don't appear to have any kind of mental health condition. In fact, they are mentally stronger than average, because typically they're handling huge amounts of stress and better than the average person would handle it. It's just finally having an impact on their bodies, but they are carrying very large amounts of stress and managing it very well. And that's why this condition can happen to pretty much anybody. And you would not suspect how much stress these patients are carrying until you start asking these into these five areas. And the five areas are, first of all, very simple: stress in your life at the moment. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And can you find a connection between stress that's happening in your life right now, especially stress that happened right before your symptoms were triggered? Can you find a correlation or a linkage between stress levels going up and down and symptom levels going up and down? Second area are there are actually three mental health conditions that are manifesting in the body instead of as a mental health complaint. So somebody who's got severe depression, severe anxiety, or a severe post-traumatic stress, they're probably going to come straight to your office and try to get help. But there are a lot of other people that have those same conditions in a somewhat milder form, depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress, and it manifests in their body. And you ask them, do you feel depressed? And they're like, no, not really. Stressed out, exasperated, frustrated, desperate to have you alleviate whatever the physical symptom is that's brought them to your office. But no, they're not really feeling that depressed. So you have to dig deeper. You have to ask some of the questions about other manifestations of depression that I'm sure you do on a daily basis. How's your sleeping? How's your appetite? How's your energy? Have you been crying for no obvious reason? Have you lost interest in activities you used to love to do? Mm-hmm. Has your life seemed to have lost its purpose or meaning? And when I ask those questions of these patients, I get the yes answers one after another.
Right. And the other thing, too, is people don't always recognize that that depression can show up actually as irritability.
Yes. Right?
Most people, they tend to think of it's the Eeyore kind of depression, the slow talking and the slow movements and the, you know, the head and the hunched over, those kind of things. But they don't realize it can be, of being irritable and sometimes agitated.
Yeah, that's a great insight. And, you know, anxiety is the same way, that many people who clearly have an anxiety disorder, they all say they don't feel especially anxious. And it's because they've been so anxious for so long that it just feels normal to them. But
yep, yes, they're normal.
And the clue there is that their physical symptoms are much worse or more frequent when they're away from what they consider a safe environment. One of my patients got her attacks of illness a couple of times a week for many months. But not a single one of those attacks took place in her home, which for her was a safe environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your body doesn't know if you're at home or away. Only your brain knows that. So the fact that she was only getting her attacks away from home was a strong clue that the brain was involved. One of my favorite stories about anxiety disorders is a young lady who was having severe diarrhea. On her bad days, she was putting herself on a water-only diet and taking up to a dozen Imodium tablets by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Imodium being an over-the-counter diarrhea drug. And you know, nobody else got the story, though, that her bad days were always on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On the weekends, she was fine. She could eat a regular diet. She never had any problems with her bowels. So what was going on Tuesdays and Thursdays was she played varsity soccer in high school. Mm-hmm. And that was those were the days when she would play for her school. And she was very anxious about her performance in those games. So, and then finally, the post-traumatic stress. You know, so many doctors fail to ask, did you go through a trauma, a terrifying or horrifying event right before your symptoms began? And very often, that's the first time the patient has ever shared that they went through something that was, you know, extremely difficult for them. A colleague of mine tells a great story of a patient who went from doctor to doctor for 6 months with no explanation for her symptoms until he found out that right before she became ill, she had been a hostage during a store robbery and had a pistol pointed at her neck for about half an hour.
Wow.
And her symptoms began right after that.
So, you know, the thing about that, though, again, to speak in terms of us as a profession, you know, the truth of the matter is 70% of people have experienced some kind of trauma in their lives. So, you know, outside of psychiatry, that's a necessary question outside of psychiatry as much as it is within the specialty of psychiatry. And obviously as a psychiatrist, we're trained, you know, to go into people's social backgrounds and ask those kind of questions about if they had trauma or if they, you know, things are stressful or how things at home and how's the relationship with your parents. You know, when you're talking about kids and adolescents, we're taught to ask those questions, but the pervasiveness of trauma is so high that it does need to be, I think, a part of the standard questions that we ask patients. So the other thing too that you know that you know it's important to think of is like everything, trauma is an energy, and if it's not addressed and released, that energy is just something that we carry around with us. It's like I said, like this, I have a glass of water, and so wherever I move the glass, the water goes. And so the trauma is very much like that. It goes with us until we can heal it and release it. And there, of course, it's gonna show up again. Emotional dis-ease over time is going to become physical disease at some point, because we all have our breaking point, right? And, you know, I wanted to tell you a story about me that happened to affirm what you're saying is I had, I tell people my natural abilities are, you know, in writing and speaking and those kind of things. But I decided very early, like in junior high school, I wanted to become a physician. And, you know, so I found sciences and math much more challenging for me than the writing and speaking. That just came to me real easy, right? So because of the challenges that I was having over time, I convinced myself that even while I'm doing, you know, I'm taking the exam, I'm passing the exams, you know, I got into medical school, I graduated, all of that, I still somehow convinced myself that if this is such a challenge for me, then I'm not going to be able to pass my specialty boards. That was the story that I concocted. It's a little crazy story I concocted. So, and I also too was a single parent. My daughter was 11 months old when I started medical school as a single parent. And so, of course, you add on that challenge of being a single parent as well. And so just trying to get through.
Well, you're not looking around the room in class in medical school and seeing a lot of people in your same situation.
Correct. Correct. And then I had my own childhood trauma, and in terms of physical abuse, some sexual assault in my 20s. And so I'm just, but I'm, you know, but me, I'm the, you know, the smiley, happy, we got to, you know, optimistic. We got to, we're going to make it happen. We got to get it done. At times I tell people, at times in medical school, I would just sit down and cry. Right. But then we got to put it together. We got to pull it together and we got to keep moving forward.
This is what I mean when I say my patients are stronger than the average person. You're a great example.
Yes. So, but here's what happened. So because of the little story that I convinced myself of about my specialty boards, you know, I go on, I finish residency, fellowship, get licensed. But I, you know, I'm scared to take my specialty boards. And, but as my work began to shift and I was called to be on a more public platform, I'm very much aware and having the message of, you know, your infinite potential, able to do whatever your potential is here to do, to fulfill that mission. I'm going, you got to embody the message, right? And so part of embodying the message means you got to take them specialty boards. So, going to take those specialty boards and
face your fears.
But I'm telling you, when it came to the time for me to take the board, I mean, I'm in terror. And that is not an exaggeration of how I felt about taking them. So the day of the exam, when I take my general psychiatry specialty boards, guess what happens?
You got physically ill.
It started up, which was, I realized when I get, sometimes I get highly stressed, I started getting muscle spasms in my back. And that started up. So, you know, I took some ibuprofen, it calmed down, and I was good. Go get to the test center and, you know, start taking the exam. And then I think it was this eye, it starts to hurt. And I wear contact lenses. So I take it out, clean it, put it back in. It's still hurting. I mean, like, a lot of pain, like a lot where I could have just, you know, would have been enough to quit. But I'm like, no, we're not doing that. We are not quitting. You just going to have to tough it out and get through this. And, you know, the general psychiatry boards is like 8.5 hours the first time you take them. So
that's longer than the medicine boards. Wow.
Yeah. So I forced myself, got through it. And then when I got home, guess what happened?
You felt much better.
About 2 hours later, my eyes stopped hurting. But wait. But then guess what happened? But then later on, then my back seized up. And like for 2 days, I was out. And so, you know, of course, I had to call off because I couldn't hardly even walk. And I called and spoke to the chief medical officer. And she's like, you should go see an acupuncturist. And she gave me some recommendations, but they weren't close to my home. So I found somebody close to my home. And
let me just emphasize that these symptoms are real. You know, there's nobody making this stuff up.
Correct. Correct. And the acupuncture helped tremendously. So, you know, I shared that story again, just as an example of the truth of what you're saying about how, when we're under a lot of stress, or in this case, like I said, I felt terror about taking that exam, how my body reacted so strongly to the strong emotion and frankly, you know, like I said, the fear and the terror I was feeling about that exam and then how it showed up in my body.
Yeah. And I want to emphasize too, for people in your audience, that, you know, when I look around a medical school classroom, I see plenty of straight white men out there that I can say, well, they can do it, I can do it. But if you're a person of color, if you're a person who's LGBTQ, if you've got a, you know, if you're a single parent and you're looking around that same room and you're not seeing a lot of role models that that show you, or amongst the faculty, you're not seeing a lot of role models that you can point to and say, that person is like me, they did it, that gives me confidence. And, you know, if you don't have that, it just compounds the stress.
It does. So you know what? There's definitely that aspect to it. But there's also the other dynamics. But I tell you what, let's take a break, and then when we come back, then we'll pick up, okay?
Very good.
Heaven Abounds in You takes you on an inward journey of discovery that dramatically transforms your outward experience of life. Discover the power of belief. Utilize it in connection with science to create a vision of meaning and purpose that pulls you forward. Let go of the meager me to discover the magnificent me. Let go of your painful past and live life free from fear, worry, and stagnation. Experience an abundant universe as you powerfully create happiness, relationships, health, and limitless opportunities. When you heal your mind, all things are possible.
Dr. Balan Ader here, and I am discussing Your Body Talks When Your Mouth Won't with my special guest, Dr. David Clark. And before the break, we were sharing examples about how the body reacts very strongly to stress and feelings of threat or actual experiences of threat. And you're again talking about just in terms of how challenging it can be to accomplish things when you don't have a good support system or good role or enough role models so that you can say, well, if they accomplished it, I did. And I have to say, one of the positive things about where I went to medical school, which is University of Illinois at Chicago, is that we actually had a good support system amongst the students that were, you know, African-American and Latinx and amongst the faculty. So that was helpful. We had certain residents who had attended school with us, and they would come back and, you know, provide, you know, being tutors and those kind of things. So that part was helpful. But as you well know, the amount of material and the challenges of medical school is very high. As one of my friends said to me, you know, a few years ago, he said, you do know that you actually, as a physician, were in one of the most difficult educational paths that there is in any profession. And I was like, oh, I hadn't considered that. But yeah, so, you know, so then I thought about it, I was like, yeah, he's absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that obviously I said to you was about, one, how I was having eye pain during the test and how I had, you know, the back pain before. And then, of course, after I took the exam. And so one of the things I wanted to get into, and you had talked about some of the specific illnesses already, but I definitely was specifically wanted to get into the chronic pain and how that's showing up as a consequence, like chronic pain and actually autoimmune illnesses, how that's showing up as a consequence, you know, of the stressors and traumas that you know we're experiencing, and therefore, you know, it's either misdiagnosed, you know, the doctors are going, not sure what this is, or not sure how to help you.
Yeah, and that leads directly into the fact that we didn't quite finish talking about all the pieces of the stress evaluation. So we got, and that leads, you know, back to your question about the chronic pain and what's going on there. But we talked about looking at stress in your life at the moment. We talked about making sure the person doesn't have depression, anxiety, or post-trauma. Also, there's a sub-piece of this stress in your life right now that's important to evaluate, and that is people who are living in a way that they are taking care of everybody else in their world, but they are not putting themselves on the list of people they take care of. So they're kind of on a treadmill that they never step off. They're helping their neighbors, their family, their spouse, their workplace partners, but they don't take some time for their own personal joy. And sooner or later, that can catch up with you and your body can start to tell you that it's not happy with the way things are going.
Yeah, and they didn't put their own oxygen mask on first, then assist others.
Great analogy. Absolutely. And if you do that for too long, you know, it can make you physically ill for sure. Many people who have that issue grew up in challenging home circumstances where they didn't get sufficient opportunities to play. There was too much going on in that household that pulled their attention away from themselves, where it belongs a good part of the time when you're a kid. And they had to, you know, try and fix the problems that were going on in that household. They never learned how to play. And so as adults, it's a foreign concept. What they know is that they need to be fixing the problems of other people that they know.
And taking care of the adults.
Yes. Yes. And then that leads.
Sometimes, and that taking care of the adults can look like a couple ways. One, physically taking care of them, or taking care of siblings, younger siblings, right? Or the emotional caretaking of the adults in the household.
And it can lead to choosing relationship partners, frankly, where the relationship is not balanced, where the other individual gets a whole lot more support and time and effort than the patient gets back in return. Because that's what they grew up with. They grew up focused on the needs of people who had issues, and they tend to choose people to be in those relationships with as adults. So that leads finally into the one of the biggest parts of the stress evaluation, which is, were you under stress as a child? And if you were, how bad was it on a scale of 0 to 10? And what happened to you that makes you give it the number that you do? And a lot of people will tell me, well, yes, this, that, and the other not so good thing happened to me when I was a child, but I don't think it was that bad. Mm-hmm. I think other people have been through worse than me and they seem to be okay. Or I think it was, you know, so far in the past that I'm over it now. So then when I hear that, I ask people to imagine that there was a child you cared about who was growing up exactly as you did. And you're a butterfly on the wall of your childhood home, and you're watching this kid, whether it's your own child or somebody else's, you're watching that child try to cope. And you can't do anything because you're a butterfly on the wall. So what is it like watching that happen? Is this going to make you feel sad or angry to watch what's happening? And for many people, that cuts through all of the defenses, and you see their facial expressions change often dramatically, because it's one thing to look back on your own life and say, well, you know, I kind of dealt with it. But when you imagine the same thing happening to an innocent child whom you know, completely different ballgame, gives people a much more accurate recognition of what really happened.
Yeah. Because of course it touches the heart, right?
It definitely does. You know, if I can share one story about that, there was a patient who was actually, you know, somewhat known to the public, whom I get some interesting referrals these days. And I was talking to her about her early experience, which was as the peacemaker between her parents. Her parents were constantly verbally and emotionally battling with each other. And she was the only child. And from as long as she can remember, she was trying to fix things between them. And obviously, as a little kid, was not being successful. But she did her best on a daily basis, unfortunately. So then her parents get divorced when she's 8 years old. And you think that might, you know, finally lead to some relief, some kind of a break for her. But no, unfortunately, the parents kept living in the same house. They slept in separate bedrooms, but they kept living in the same house. So they were still, you know, at each other all day long. And as far as she was concerned, things were no better than they were before the divorce. So she had to put up with this for 18 years until she left for college. And yeah, it just sounded horrendous. And I said, you know, that this sounds like enormous pressure that you were under, mm-hmm. and you never got a chance to really be a child. And she's telling me, oh, no, it wasn't that bad. And I dealt with it. I don't think this is possibly relevant to the fact that she'd had 20 years of psychophysiologic symptoms. And her personal relationships with her various boyfriends were also just terrible, one after mm-hmm. another. Yeah. So I asked her this same thought experiment. All right, we're going to imagine that your beloved niece, you know, she had 6-year-old niece, just absolutely adored this little girl, would take her for the weekend, would take her shopping, would take her to amusement parks. I just had a ball with this little girl. And so I said, all right, we're going to put this little girl in your home, mm-hmm. age 6. She's going to have to deal with your parents. You're going to be a butterfly on the wall, and you're going to have to watch your niece try to cope with this. What is that going to be like for you? And she just stared at me. Very verbal person. You know, she was in the public eye and she had to communicate a lot. But with that, just had to process for mm-hmm. a couple of minutes. And then finally at the end, she said, after a week of that, I would shoot myself. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time she truly recognized just how awful it had been. And that for her was the start of recognizing the heroic perseverance that was needed to endure that environment. And it helped her self-esteem a lot. It helped her to give herself more time for her own joy. It helped her to be less tolerant of mistreatment by her boyfriend. In fact, she dumped him, you know, within days, and went for a year and a half before she was ready for another relationship. Mm-hmm. So it made a big difference in her life, and her physical symptoms began to get better from that moment.
So that's great to hear that she was able to have that awareness and that understanding and was able to do that healing work for herself. But like you said, I think that again, that's a great approach to saying, if you were watching another child that you cared about in the same situation as you, and you were powerless to do anything about it, how would you feel? Yeah. So I think that's great. So I do wonder though, if you could, of course, share with us too, though, about how, again, that shows up, those kind of traumas and stressors are showing up as, you know, chronic pain and or autoimmune disorders.
Yeah. Well, it's known that adverse childhood experiences or ACEs can contribute to autoimmune diseases in adults. There was a study of that showed that the more ACEs that you had as a kid, the more likely you are to be hospitalized for an autoimmune condition. The ACEs have an impact not just on psychophysiologic disorders that we're mostly talking about today, but also on organ diseases like cancer, diabetes, heart disease, peptic ulcer, autoimmune diseases, obesity, all of those things. So it's a widespread impact, probably because the early adversity and trauma activates the body's inflammatory system. We don't know all the steps in the physiology that lead to organ disease, but that is likely to be one of the initial impacts that the adversity has on children. But it also certainly has an impact on chronic pain. The more ACEs you have, the more likely you are to suffer chronic pain as an adult. My favorite example is a 75-year-old man who had abdominal pain for 55 years. And he came back in the days before the electronic medical record, and volume 3 of his paper chart was 3 inches thick, just full of diagnostic tests and unsuccessful treatment trials. And so I just asked him my normal stress evaluation, and we got to the childhood stress part, and he'd been physically abused as a boy by his dad, who hit him with just about everything you can think of, including, you know, axe handles, among other things. And when he was 15, he couldn't take it anymore, and he just walked away and never came back. He never saw his father again. He lied about his age. He got a job with a forest products company, which we have a lot here in Oregon. And he worked in the woods for the next 50 years until he retired. Age 19, he starts having stomach pains, still having them at age 75. And I sent him to a class that we had called Adult Children of Dysfunctional Families. It was 8 or 10 people with an instructor. They met for 2 hours a week for 8 weeks. A lot of personal sharing that went on. He tended not to like to talk, especially about himself, but it was a very supportive environment. And in the third week of the classes, he hadn't said a word the first 2 weeks. Third week, he finally lets out a couple sentences about himself, and then he stops because that's, you know, all he feels comfortable doing. But the rest of the class, very savvy, they know he hasn't said anything up to then, so they all just sit there and look at him, and nobody says a thing. And he's getting very uncomfortable with this, and he finally starts talking again. And once he starts, he can't stop. And he goes on for 35 or 40 minutes is what he told me, just telling his story to this very supportive group. And, you know, make a long story short, I tend to be long-winded about these things because I just love these stories. But he stopped having pain at that point. He finished the remaining 7 classes with no pain. He came back to see me 2 or 3 weeks after that, still no pain.
So yeah, and actually what I wanted to also get into as a segue into this was two things. One, that I know that there's some overlap in how the body processes both emotional pain and chronic pain. They're not exactly the same, but there's definitely overlap in them. Because I think people at times find it kind of go, why under, you know, emotional stress or depression or other, you know, anxiety, or, you know, or even if somebody rejects me, right, a relationship comes to an end, you know, why do I physically feel that in my body? And again, the body is actually designed so that it has multiple purposes for the same structures. They'll have multiple functions. So it's so we're definitely coming into that understanding about, again, the overlap in emotional and physical pain. But you were saying one, they're not understanding what it is about that process that then causes the body to attack itself, because that's an autoimmune disorder. When it attacks itself, we think it's inflammation, but not sure how, right?
Yeah, it can be. It seems like it can be triggered by adverse childhood experiences that activate the inflammatory system in the body at an early age, and that can play out into an increased risk of autoimmune disease in the adult years. It was just one study, but it was very well done, and I have a lot of respect for it, and it makes sense to me from a physiologic standpoint. But we're still working out all the details of how physiologically that process goes from the initial childhood adversity into a disease that may not manifest for decades later. But it's very clear that there's a strong association there.
Okay. So then you also mentioned early on that CBT really is not effective in these instances, but pain psychotherapy is. So what is it that's different about pain psychotherapy?
Yeah, very insightful question. Thank you. There are several differences. One is that the goal of pain psychotherapy is to relieve the symptoms, not just help you live with it. We are actively trying to make this pain or illness go away. A second aspect of it is that we are shifting your attention from the place in your body where you are having these symptoms up to the brain where the symptoms are actually generated. And from the brain, we want to know, you know, why is your brain doing this? It's because there's a stress in your life, either from the past or present or both, that has not been fully recognized or dealt with. So from the brain, we're going into your life and trying to figure out what the stress is. And the stress very often, especially in the severe cases, has to do with the long-term impact of childhood adversity. And there are several different manifestations of that. One are stressful personality traits, traits that people have developed in order to help them survive the childhood adversity. Mm-hmm. Things like perfectionism, excessive self-criticism, not asserting yourself, not taking time to meet your own needs. Low self-esteem goes along with that. Being detail-oriented, being highly self-critical, being compassionate towards others, often to the point of your own detriment, where you're devoting yourself to the needs of other people. So all of those can add up to a pretty significant stress level. Second long-term impact of childhood adversity are triggers, which are people, situations, or events in the present day that are stressful for you because they have links or echoes or connections to adversity of the past. The most common of those would be an adult who mistreated you as a kid, who's still in your life today. And then finally,
also some of the triggers can also be things like scents, right? Smells.
Yes.
Or other sensations, or like you said, or just visual cues, things that you see in the environment. And of course, sometimes being triggered can people respond aggressively when they're triggered, whether that's verbal, you know, and or physically.
Yeah, the aggressive response that those patients tend to find their way to your office instead of mine. But absolutely, that can be a way that people react to triggers.
Right. Or the freezing, right? Or
yes.
That freeze or the avoidant response to a trigger also.
Absolutely. And then the final long-term impact is repressed emotions. Many of my patients have tremendous amounts of anger, fear, sometimes shame, grief, or guilt that they're not consciously aware of. Mm-hmm. And yet it's those emotions because, you know, as the title of today's episode, if you can't put them into words, they need to manifest themselves in some other way. Mm-hmm. And they'll do it into your body. One of my patients was hospitalized at a prestigious university 60 times in 15 years with no diagnosis for these attacks she was having of severe dizziness and vomiting. Mm-hmm. And she saw a dozen specialists, including a psychiatrist, who didn't know what to look for and mm-hmm. who completely missed the fact that she had been abused emotionally and verbally by her mother. For 47 of her 50 years, and mother was still doing this to her at the age of 50. And these episodes of the dizziness and vomiting were all linked to interactions with her mother. And she had never put it together because her emotional tension towards her mother, the anger towards her mother, was so buried that she couldn't see it. Until I was able to make the connection explicitly for her and make it obvious to her.
So Dr. Clark, so tell me in this last few seconds, how can folks get in touch with you?
The email address, info@ppdassociation.org. It's a kind of a long one, info@ppd, which is short for psychophysiologic disorders, ppdassociation.org is the best way. And the material on our website, which we're always upgrading and improving and adding to, is going to give people a lot of insight. We've got a wonderful 12-item self-assessment quiz for people that are wondering if any of these ideas might apply to them. That self-assessment quiz, the more questions to which you answer yes, the more likely it is that your pain or illness are linked to these kinds of issues.
That's great that you have that resource available. And, you know, I'm thinking about an earlier conversation that you and I had where you had said you thought that you were going to have an ordinary career. And I just want to say that there is nothing about you in my experience that is ordinary. You're absolutely extraordinary. I'm so grateful to have you here today, to have the conversation. And while we have so much ground to cover that we haven't yet, you know what this means? It means we're going to have some other conversations.
That would be great. It's wonderful to speak with a psychiatrist that understands the importance of the mind and its connection to the body. And I appreciate your sharing your platform with me today.
Thank you so much. And you are welcome. And so we'll push the pause button for now. Okay. I'm your host, Dr. Balan A. Durr, awakening and empowering you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in a sweet spot. I'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit BalanADurrMD.com, spelled BalanADurrMD.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.